Janet Jackson, Super Bowl halftime show. I don't even have to say anything else. And probably most of you are thinking about the same thing. You're thinking about the wardrobe dysfunction that took place during the Super Bowl halftime show this year, 2004. Wardrobe dysfunction was the way it was described euphemistically later to describe Jackson's public exposure on national television. The truth is that what happened during the halftime Super Bowl show had little to do with dysfunctional clothing and more to do with the desire on public television, national television, to push the envelope, to get as close as possible to the national decency standards set by the FCC and yet not violate them. And the inevitable result or consequence of ending up going over the limit. That's what happened. I suspect that Jackson's public exposure was unintended. I did not see the halftime show. But from what I have read, and of course through all of the furor that followed that show and the event of her exposure, it appears to me that the entire halftime show, the music and the choreography, the dancing that was accompanying that music, that all of that was in fact intended to tantalize and to shock people. Hollywood and the entertainment industry in general seems to believe that the best way to attract the attention of the American public is to be more outrageous than the last act that the public saw. Fact of the matter is, you can't shock the public unless you're willing to go farther in terms of flaunting moral standards than those who currently have the attention of the American public. Is it any wonder that American television is in kind of a spiral downward into greater and greater depths of uncleanness and lasciviousness? I know it's dangerous to simply condemn all television. I'm not doing that, but I'm saying to you that if we'll be honest with ourselves, we understand there have been some changes that have taken place since television was first introduced into our society. And television, I believe, has been largely responsible for some changes in the moral standard of Western society, of our society. This business of shocking people to draw attention, I believe, is the same reason that the fashion industry, year after year, is constantly designing clothes whose fundamental purpose is to draw attention to the wearer. Now, obviously, they're not going to sell many potato sacks if that's what they design for this year's spring fashion. But it is unnecessary for individuals to design clothing that is revealing and provocative if their sole intention is to provide apparel that is attractive and decent. Styles of clothing tend, year after year, to be more revealing or daring than the previous year's styles. Modesty is a concept that seems to figure little or none at all in the design of popular clothing. I have heard young mothers and even women in general speak of the fact that it's difficult if you want to go out and buy a dress. It can be very difficult to find clothing that is not immodest, that is acceptable along biblical standards. Now, all that I've described to you, the furor over the Jackson incident and what's happening with clothing styles, all of that would be of little consequence to us, except that Christians are sometimes influenced by the desire to be like the world, to conform to the world, Paul understood that temptation and begged his readers in Romans chapter 12 and verses 1 and 2 to present their bodies as living sacrifices, not to be conformed to the world, to be like the world, but to be transformed, to be changed, to undergo a metamorphosis from what they were to, as Steve read from Colossians 3, to the new man in Christ Jesus. This morning I want to talk to you a little bit about modesty, about shame and modesty. And my intent is twofold. I want to note some of the important considerations in determining modesty. And I speak not just of clothing, but also of behavior. Behavior can also be described as either modest or immodest. Although we tend to use that word more with respect to apparel or clothing, still the concept can apply to even our behavior. And then, of course, secondly, and most importantly, I want to encourage all of us, men and women alike, to dress and behave in a modest fashion. I'm not real sympathetic with the FCC. Their reaction to what took place during the halftime show was hypocritical, to say the least. This is the same organization that just recently decided that it's acceptable on national television and radio for individuals to use obscenity that was previously forbidden. But that's okay now under certain circumstances. Then the Jackson incident takes place, and they're all shocked and galvanized into action. And I find their reaction hypocritical, to say the least. But I will tell you this, they have an impossible job. The job of enforcing standards of decency in a society that has largely lost its sense of shame. It is a task that will not get done. They can't win because of what's happening in our culture, in our society. It's interesting to me the way that the Scriptures talk about modest apparel. The Scriptures don't talk about modesty in terms of numbers or in some sort of divine dress code. That would be difficult anyway, because the Scriptures would then tend to relate more to a particular culture or time. But instead, the Scriptures deal with the attitudes, the emphases that are behind modesty. And that makes the instructions of the Scriptures in this particular area timeless, especially so. For instance, there are a couple of passages that deal particularly with modesty, New Testament passages. One was read by Brother Barry this morning, 1 Peter the 3rd chapter, verses 1 through 6, and I'm hoping it's appearing on the screen behind me even as we speak. As Peter talks about how women should behave, particularly, he says, women whose husbands are not members of the Lord's church, who are not Christians, not believers, he says that they need to be submissive to their own husbands. And I would suggest to you that down in verse 5, the same concept is once again addressed. Actually, that's really the point of all of this. That rather than women being so concerned about their outward apparel, what they need to be concerned about is their responsibility to be submissive. And in so doing, they adorn the inner person. As he says, the inner, the hidden person of the heart. And they adorn that hidden man, or that inner man, with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle or meek, as the American Standard Version reads, and quiet spirit. Emphasis, Peter says, is to be placed on adorning the hidden person of the heart rather than the outward appearance. He says in verse 3, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather let it be. It's not wrong for a woman to be attractive. It's not wrong for her to pay attention to the way she looks. But if that becomes her emphasis and she neglects the inner person, if she is not submissive, if she's not adorning the inner man with that gentle and quiet spirit, then she's missing the point. And she's poorly adorned or dressed as far as God is concerned. What's interesting to me is that in the words of Peter here, the contrast is not between skimpy and revealing clothing and character. It is between the gentle and quiet spirit, which speaks of character, and the drawing attention to oneself. Did you notice that in verse 3? That there's nothing said there about what we typically think of as immodest apparel. Apparel that is revealing or provocative or sexually suggestive in some way. But instead it talks about the drawing of attention to oneself. And that gives us some clue as to the important emphasis behind prohibitions against immodesty. Character determines conduct. And the hidden person of the heart, if it is properly adorned with a gentle and quiet spirit, will manifest chaste conduct, which is what is admonished in verses 2 and, of course, in verse 4. Another passage that likewise addresses this topic of modesty and even uses the word of modest is 1 Timothy 2, verses 8 through 10. We'll back up to verse 8, although it talks about men in specific. In verse 8, Paul writes, "I desire, therefore, that the men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. In like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness, with good works." And so women, Paul says, are to adorn themselves in modest apparel and with good works, he says in verse 10. And like Peter, Paul likewise does not specifically mention skimpy or revealing clothing. Rather, he mentions those items of apparel that would tend to draw attention to oneself. And we'll come back to this point a little bit later on because I believe there is a connection between drawing attention to oneself and what we typically think of as revealing or skimpy clothing, immodest apparel. But it's interesting to me that what's emphasized here are the attitudes of propriety and moderation. Godliness. Women who profess godliness will dress in a particular way. It'll be modest apparel that they'll choose. The word moderation here is a word that refers to sound judgment, self-control, decency. It refers to the ability of a woman to look at her wardrobe or to make a decision about what she's going to wear and make that decision based on what she knows is right. She is able to do, to make herself do, what she knows she ought to do. That's what moderation speaks of. It talks about that self-control that sometimes people don't exhibit. They know what's right. They end up doing something else because of their weakness. Paul says this woman needs to dress herself in apparel with sound judgment, self-control, determining what it is that she chooses to wear. And when that's the case, if she has been properly educated in biblical principles of lasciviousness and uncleanness, if she knows what those things involve, then she'll choose the right kind of clothing. Those are the governing principles for modesty, propriety, and moderation. Now, as I suggested already, the matter of wishing to attract attention to oneself is not unrelated to skimpy or revealing clothing. I don't want to offend anyone by bringing up an indelicate subject, but why is it that a prostitute wears revealing clothing? Because she is in the business of attracting the attention of men. That's her job. That's her profession. And sometimes I think we're just flat dishonest with ourselves when we suggest that that's not our intention if we are dressing in the same kind of fashion, in revealing, provocative clothing, clothing that clings and reveals. The prostitute wishes to attract attention, so she wears that kind of clothing. In Proverbs chapter 7 and in verse 10, as the writer Solomon talks to his son, he at least addresses his readers in terms of the father exhorting his son, he talks about a foolish young man who is encouraged by a woman, an immoral woman, And the expression, the attire of a harlot, is used there. She is recognizable by what she wears. Her clothing has a purpose, and people know what that purpose is. And so the desire to attract attention to oneself. Now, understand, I'm not saying that makes a person a harlot. I'm saying the harlot dresses for that purpose. And her dress, incidentally or not incidentally, is revealing and skimpy because that's her purpose. She wants to attract attention. And men and women alike need to examine their purpose for what it is that they wear. Is it to attract attention to ourselves? And perhaps for base motives? Rather than just being attractive in general. But we want to focus people's attention, and perhaps for the purpose of creating lust or evil desires, things that, as Steve read a little bit earlier from Colossians 3, the Christian ought to be putting away, not be a part of our lives. In 1 Timothy chapter 2 and in verse 9, the passage that is up on the screen, the word propriety in the American Standard Version is an interesting word. The word that is used in that version is shamefastness. That's not a word we use very much, but I will tell you that that translation introduces a whole concept that is absolutely crucial if we're going to understand this concept or this idea of modesty in both apparel and behavior. Shamefastness suggests the idea of being made fast or bound by a sense of shame at doing that which is immoral or dishonorable. Shame, Webster says, is a painful emotion excited by a consciousness of guilt, shortcoming, or impropriety. When a person feels guilty, shame accompanies that. It is an emotion which is intimately connected to the conscience, whose job, whose function is to either approve or disapprove of the things that we do and say and think based on how it has been educated, how it's been trained. The conscience takes the standard that we recognize of right and wrong and measures our conduct against that standard and either pronounces us guilty or innocent in the various activities that we engage in. And shame is produced when the conscience says, you're guilty. Shame is the capacity to feel this emotion that Webster defines as a painful emotion. The recognition of shortcoming and impropriety. Blushing is the physiological symptom of that emotion, the capacity of feeling that emotion. I find it interesting that Webster says that it's a painful emotion, and he is right. It can be extremely painful, not in a literal physical sense, but in an emotional sense, in an inner man sense. It can be extremely painful to be shamed by what one has done. And yet shame, like physical, literal physical pain, performs a good function. When your body can no longer feel pain in your extremities, in your hands, in your feet, or in other places, you're in a world of trouble. Because that's a warning system. It's how the body warns you, how the brain warns you through the nervous system that you're engaged in something or you're in some situation or some circumstances that's destructive to your body. And it warns you that you need to move, you need to change something. Put your hand on a hot stove and your body says, change it now, and you do it quickly. Shame operates the same way. In the same way as this physical pain, it will warn you when you are doing something that's wrong, something that is contrary to the standard of right and wrong that you have been taught. And in fact, we will even order our conduct so as to avoid pain when we understand we associate pain with certain conduct. certain actions. And in the same way, when we associate shame with certain behavior, we'll avoid that behavior because we don't want to suffer the shame. Shame's a good thing in that sense, the capacity to feel shame. Shame's never pleasant, but it certainly can perform a good function, a good purpose in our lives. It'll keep us from evil sometimes, where otherwise we might participate. And I will tell you with some sadness something that's not any revelation to you, and that is that our nation suffers from a lack of shame. Our population is not shamed by the doing of the immoral or the dishonorable, and the same-sex marriage thing that's going on right now in California and Massachusetts is just pure evidence of that point. We've lost the ability to blush at things that are shameful. Paul calls homosexuality shameful in Romans 1 and verse 27. But it's not considered shameful by many people in our country. Oh, a lot of people don't like it. But it's not considered shameful. Our nation has abandoned, in large, the divine standard of right and wrong, and so feels no shame at behavior that violates that standard. I said that a sense of shame is intimately connected to the conscience. The conscience is not an infallible guide. It is a guide that needs to be registered. It needs to be oriented to the right standard. And sometimes people think that things are okay and their consciences approve of things that the Bible would condemn, that God's will says is sinful. That's a poorly trained conscience. And so sometimes people engage in things with no shame because they consider those things to be okay, to be right. These things that I'm telling you now suggest some truths. The capacity to feel shame is God-given, much like the capacity to become angry is a God-given thing, emotion. Anger in and of itself is not wrong. It is a natural thing under certain circumstances, but it has to be controlled. The capacity to suffer shame, however, I should say the actual feeling of shame, depends upon both an acceptance and an understanding of some standard of right and wrong. And that's what's gotten us in trouble. Because our nation has abandoned the divine standard of right and wrong. And unfortunately, some Christians are just following along behind. They think that the standard of right and wrong is set by the civil law. And nothing could be further from the truth. You and I are responsible to God's law first, and man's law secondarily. But there are some other things that are implied. For instance, it is certainly the case, we taught the divine standard of modesty, and the younger the better. If young girls are taught before they're even 5 years old that there's certain clothing that's inappropriate, that is shameful, that it is shameful for them to display their bodies, then we won't have problems with them nearly to the extent that a lot of people do when they're 15. You have to start young. It's too late when they're 12 and 13 and 14 years old. They've already adopted a standard. And it may not be the right standard. It frequently is not. It's often the standard of the world. That's what they've been indoctrinated by television and their friends and various other sources of influence. Children have to be taught the standard, or they will feel no shame. They have the God-given capacity to feel shame, but they need to know what's shameful so they can avoid those things, and so that shame does push them away from them when they do commit them. What I'm going to say now, I want to address to the young people. And a lot of them are sitting up here, but not all of them. Those who are unmarried and who are dating or looking at the opposite sex, thinking about the possibility of a lifetime relationship with that young man or young woman, hopefully the right sex. We can't seem to get it straight anymore in this country, but I'm sure you will. May I suggest to you, don't date those who display by their apparel and their behavior that the only way they can attract attention is by revealing their bodies. Because if you do that, you are selecting a shallow person. Look for the people who show character. Select those people who draw attention to themselves by their goodness, by the depth of their maturity, their spiritual maturity, not the shape of their bodies. I'm impressed with our young people. I hope you are too. And I hope from time to time you encourage them. I try to do that. You make a lot of good decisions, and that's obvious from the way you behave here and in other circumstances. And I'm encouraged by that. But I will tell you that a lot of young people make this mistake. They are focused on the exterior, just like Peter said women should not be. We ought to be focused on the interior and looking for the people who are properly adorned inside. Who, as Steve read, I didn't coordinate this with Steve, but he read the right passage this morning in Colossians 3. People who have put on the new man, who are transformed by putting off the old man with all of those evil desires, and who are looking to things that are above. And so, in the good decisions that you have made, I commend you and I encourage you to choose someone with the kind of character that brings legitimate attention, because it makes them good mates, good spouses. Well, I appreciate your patience this morning. Paul mentioned another attitude in 1 Timothy 2 that we've not said much about. It is the matter of godliness. Godliness, I suppose, could probably be just briefly described as the devotion that seeks to please God. It's that piety that causes people to do the things that make God approve of them or happy with them. And Paul talked about how women who profess godliness will adorn themselves. They'll dress in modest apparel with moderation and propriety, shamefastness, as the American Standard Version translates it. And that kind of devotion will determine not only how we dress, but how we behave in other ways. So that our behavior, likewise, is not immodest, does not draw undue or improper attention to ourselves. We're not born feeling shame over modesty. We have to be taught as children what constitutes appropriate and inappropriate clothing and behavior. Do not assume that your children will automatically understand what they should wear and what they shouldn't wear, the way they should behave and the way they shouldn't behave. Their sense of shame at the ungodly must arrive from the fact that they have been taught what the standard is. And it's never too early to start teaching that standard in the most simplest terms. What we've been talking about this morning is basically people whose lives are focused on something in the future, who have set their thoughts on things that are above, things that are in the future. They live in hope of eternal life. And it may be that that's not the way that you've been living your life. Maybe you've been living your life for your own benefit and living in the here and now and pretty much governed by whatever impulses come from the world. But what the Bible encourages us to do is to look to Jesus Christ. He offers the loving care of a shepherd, the forgiveness of sins that is available through His blood. If you believe that He's the Christ, the Son of God, you need to act on that faith. And repenting of your sins, turn your back on those things of the world and confess that faith. Before this audience this morning, we'll baptize you. We'll assist you in being buried with Christ in baptism, so that you can enter the spiritual family of God, and then you'll do just like other Christians. You'll set your goal on heaven, and you'll dress and you'll behave in such a way as to please God, because that's really our goal every day and in every activity. If that appeals to you, if those blessings are not yours but you'd like them, we encourage you, come to the front. We'll assist you even as we sing to encourage you. Let's stand and sing.